Hi and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 3rd of December 2023. This is your host, Nigel Creaser. And today we've got the second part of my interview with Glenn Parker, the Positive Influence Guy. Enjoy. So I have a number of sponsors. Affiliate links in the way that it's set up that have kindly allowed me to share their services, really. The first one is Mike Kling, and Mike runs PM online PM courses, and it is a great resource for getting those fundamentals of project management trained, reasonably priced, and Mike presents it in an accessible and clear manner. You can check out some of his videos on his YouTube channel and kind of give you a view of where they are. But the code for that, if you go to nigelcreaser.com/onlinepmcourses, all one word, lowercase, that'll redirect you to it. There's varying different levels that you can buy. You can buy individual courses, you can buy pathways as well, if you like. And I get a kickback off those. Mike kindly shares me that. So if you do jump on and use it, I hope you find it really useful. I think he has money back guarantees and things like that as well. So there's a very limited risk on that. So jump on that. And that again, it's nigelcreaser.com/onlinepm. courses, and enjoy. So if you're listening to this, that means you've had a week's gap from episode one, part one, which means that you've had a week where you've been wondering what on earth was going to be said next in the next pieces. Wondering what other nuggets of information were coming from my guest. And you've had a week where you haven't been able to apply those nuggets because you didn't know they existed or what they were. Which is a little bit frustrating, really. Because imagine how much more efficient, productive, or amazing you could have been. But you know there's a way around it. You know that you can pop along to Patreon. www.patreon.com/SundayLunchPM, or to Spotify, have a look at the feed, and there's a little lock. Click on the lock and it'll ask you to pay. It's the price of a coffee. That's it. A month. And you'll get everything a week early. And you won't have bits like this in it with me wittering on about becoming a patron and things like that. So, have a think. And anyway, I'll shut up now because you're probably thinking, just get on with it, Nigel. So yeah, here's the second part of the show. What would you say with the traits of successful organisations and successful positive influence in those environments, and how you would contrast it to a normal delivery of things and management of organisations?
Well, what I. A lot of things, leaders learned a lot during this time. They learned a lot about themselves. They learned a lot about how to be more effective leaders. And they also learned a lot about their people during this time, because there's a heightened awareness because of the crisis. Well, they also sort of relearned some things that they had been taught but hadn't used, for example. So, and yes, you're right about the some extraordinary teamwork that happened. We had a similar thing in New York City. There's a large convention center called the Javits Convention Center, which houses these, you know, major trade shows and conventions. Yeah. And they turned it into a 2,500-bed field hospital in about 2 weeks. The employees there, the craft employees at the Javits Center and the Army Corps of Engineers, who knows how to do this stuff,
yeah.
They do it everywhere. They came in and collaborated and did it. There was tremendous collaboration that doesn't get talked about a lot in developing the vaccines. I mean, 9 months for a pharmaceutical company to come up with a vaccine is extraordinary. And the public-private cooperation, because the government provided the money and these pharmaceutical companies put everything aside in order to do this. And the degree of efficacy of these vaccines is extraordinary. They work, and it's never been done before. So
no.
That kind of cooperation, we examples of there was a what happened with a lot of the leaders is they started to the more concern and caring about the employees, how were they doing, and where possible they got out of their office and they started walking the floors if they could. In a hospital, they were walking the floors of the hospital, the CEOs, saying to the employees, saying to the nurses and doctors, how are you doing?
Yeah.
What do you need? How can I help? And they did. I mean, they told them we need more ventilators or N95 masks or some, you know, that sort. And it was the really effective leaders said, well, I'll get it for you. Or I got to tell you, supply chain is killing us. We probably won't be able to get it for a while. But here's what we're doing in the interim. So they were out there talking to people, saying, look, if you need something, if you need to take some time off because of the stress, you can imagine working in a hospital during that kind of period. I mean, it was extraordinary. I've talked to people who did it. And so do you need to talk to a counselor? We're making psychologists on staff available, ministers and other religious leaders available also as counselors. When they couldn't do that, and by the way, the Amtrak people were walking the floors, walking the corridors of the stations. They were riding the trains. Same thing, asking, what can we do? How can we help? And trying to simplify things for them. Of course, you know, we hear about all these incidents on airplanes where people wouldn't wear a mask and were being very disruptive and the like. Well, you know, trains had the same had the same prohibition. You had to wear a mask. But what they said to onboard employees, we're more concerned about you. So do not confront, don't get into a fight with any passenger who doesn't want to wear a mask. Just say to the other passenger or the passenger next to them or any other passenger in that car, if you're not comfortable here, you can change your seat and move to another car or another seat where you're more comfortable, and not engage with that person, because that's not their job to get into a physical fight with somebody on the train. In other instances, I talked to a gentleman who's the CEO of a company that owns 21 owns and operates 21 restaurants. He obviously couldn't walk the floors of 21 restaurants, but he had regular phone calls with the 21 general managers, and they started to, he asked them, you know, how's it going? What are you doing? And they talked about how they were adapting to the situation. Sometimes it was they reduced the menu. They changed the menu because, again, they had supply chain issues too.
Yeah.
Couldn't get a lot of things. They can't get employees to work. So they adjusted their shifts. So on the call, Nigel, they're sharing all this information with each other. And so one general manager would say, this is what's worked for us. And the other one would say, you know, I haven't tried that. I'm going to try that. And so what he said to us, the CEO, he said, prior to this, those 21 restaurants were in competition with each other. everybody wanted to be the number one restaurant by all their measures, you know, revenue, customer satisfaction, and the like. Now they became cooperative and collaborative. And he said, we're not going back. Going forward, we're going to still operate that way because it worked.
Yeah.
And more of that sort of thing where there was more collaboration, more caring, and this would surprise a lot of people, more empowerment. Because what people found is that employees were making decisions on their own because there was no management and supervision around. They were dealing with a customer, with a patient, with a client. They had to make decisions on the spot about how to handle this situation. And they did. And you know what? The leaders discovered, you know, we got some pretty smart people out there.
Yeah.
And we haven't been using them. We got some very smart people that have been underutilized.
Yeah.
And we got to, you know, this empowerment thing, which we've read about in some books, it actually works.
It's funny with that triggers a thought of mine of the Southwest Airlines and Tom Kelleher. Is it Tom Kelleher? I think it is. And that kind of devolution, and I'm not sure if that carried on, but it's kind of to the employees to make a decision with the priority of the customer, and that customer's journey was the priority, not the businesses making the money on the ticket, which made them successful. And that's it. You're talking about the same thing there, aren't you? If you've got someone in a restaurant, this person's not happy with what they've had, although there's nothing wrong from what you, and the person's, you can make the decision to go, well, okay, I'll get you something else, that's fine, throw it in the bin, they are good. There might be an awkward customer, but you've created a positive experience for them in that restaurant. And if you've made that decision, whereas otherwise I need to go and get my manager, the manager comes in, the manager does it anyway. I had to call the manager over is the message that's left to that person when they go. Whereas the other one is the person, oh yeah, they were really good, they're really helpful, they just looked after me. And that empowerment, as you say, people talk about it, but it doesn't always translate into actions, does it? And giving people those boundaries and those borders within organizations.
Yeah, and so that happened. More, what was needed was more communication during this time because there was so much being thrown at us. The really good managers, the really good effective leaders, communicated sometimes with limited information. Because the ones who didn't communicate were the ones that would not put out a directive, would not put out a communication, unless they had complete information.
Yeah.
And as a result, when you do that sort of thing, what do? You leave the employees to try to figure it out for themselves, and they're being bombarded with information by a whole bunch of different people. They're listening, they're reading social media, they're listening to the television, and they're hearing all kinds of, well, look, maybe the vaccine's bad for you, or maybe you shouldn't do this, or we should do that. One of the people that we interviewed said, one of the things we had to get used to, this is one of the leaders that we interviewed, he said we had to get used to operating with incomplete information. We had to get comfortable with saying to our employees, look, based on the information that we have right now, this is what we've decided to do. But stay tuned, because tomorrow it may change when we get additional information. So it was a big change for us to make decisions and put out and communicate with employees based on what we knew was fragments of information. Because, you know, you're getting information from your industry sources, from your government sources at all levels, from the health authorities putting out information. So it's coming at you, just you're being bombarded with information, and you're not sure which one is accurate. You're not sure if you understand it. Some of the stuff comes out in highly arcane medical terms and technical and jargon that a lot of people just don't quite understand. So that was an issue also. So getting comfortable with communicating with information and not, by the way, sugarcoating, covering up, denying, trying to deceive people, being as honest as you can and saying, this is what we know now, and this is what we're going to decide to do, and things may change in the future, you know, but we will let you know when it does. So people understood, the employees understood that the leaders cared about them. They were concerned about their health and safety because they realized people were worried about coming to work and getting sick. That was a concern of people. And they wanted to make sure that they understood that we care about you. And so being authentic about that, being honest with the communication, for example, really elevated their credibility as leaders. I want to talk about some of the things that the leaders learned, because it's some powerful stuff, Nigel, and I want to share with you some of the quotes that people shared with us based on their experience, because we asked them, what did you learn about yourself as a leader, and what did you learn about people in your organization? Well, one of the things that they said they learned was, I don't have to always be the smartest person in the room. And you know the old expression, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. As one of them said to us, or that I had to be always the first person to pop up with the answer to a problem. That we had some pretty smart people, and we needed to, you know, let them go. And let them do some problem solving and communication. So that was one of the critical things that came out of it. But they also learned that crisis leadership is stressful. It was a very stressful time for leaders, and it impacted them in a very, very dramatic way. And I just want to... I just want to share with you some of these, and your listeners, some of these things that people said to us. This is somebody in the hospitality industry said, Glenn, I took things too personally. It got to me. I had a heart attack. I learned from that experience that I need to go more with the flow and empower my staff. And by the way, I've been in touch with a number of these leaders, including him, and he's doing fine. Another leader said, I tend to internalize a lot of stress in trying to be there for everybody. I felt that people in the organization expected me always to be there, creating stress. Yeah. Another one in health, this is one of the CEOs in healthcare, I had to be positive in the face of the virus. I had to and did overcome my personal fear of getting sick and yet go to work every day. I even surprised myself. So there was all this stress on the leaders, not only stress on the employees, but stress on the leaders. And it was a very difficult time. But they learned, as I said earlier, about empowerment, that their own people, many of them, will surprise you. And that's a nice surprise to have. And I got some pretty smart people here, and I need to let them go. Now, some people will also disappoint you. It's not a perfect world. Some people will disappoint you. They will quit. They will. They just can't take it. They go. They leave. And, you know, that's important to know, because in the end, you want to know who you can depend upon. Because, by the way, crises keep coming. And we don't know what the next one will be. We hope it's not as awful as COVID-19 was, but there will be other crises because there's been crises in organizations for years. So getting ready for that is a critical thing that many of the leaders learned, that they needed to be a much better prepared going forward.
It's interesting because, as you said, there's nothing. We've not certainly. There will be certain parts of the world that have dealt with it, but it was, we've not dealt with anything as intense as this since back in the 40s and 30s. That was so right. Wide-ranging and so intense. But as you say, there's always a crisis, and it's all relevant, isn't it? It's relative, sorry, to the, there may be a crisis in your team, there may be a crisis in your department, there might be a crisis in your branch, there might be a crisis in the company, and there's lots of companies now with slowdown that there are crises where their organisations are disappearing because there are crises, and there's others that are going through these crises and getting through them, and it's kind of that it kind of makes me think about it, is that the difficulties we went through COVID and the some of the positives, but not positives, some of the muscles that you had to learn to stretch and learn to use, and the tools and techniques that we dealt with. And as you say, a lot of that's come out that we are now still able to access those. But there'll be a time that will wane and our effectiveness on it. I think the mental health thing you mentioned about is certainly in the since that, the awareness, the thought of it, the impact of neurodiversity, the impact of mental health as a... and I joined them two together because I see them two as being two... they're not joined together. They seem to have risen together in awareness from my perspective. But certainly the talking about mental health is something that before COVID I would have and I had some struggles along myself. But I know that talking about people's mental health in the context that we do now, as it being a major part of an organisation's well-being to help people with their physical and their mental health, and that being part of the corporate agenda, wasn't there in 2019. It wasn't as focused and realizing, as you said, that care for people to go, well, if we haven't got these people, we haven't got a business. If we haven't got these people, we haven't got an organization of any sort, because they're the lifeblood of that organization. I think there are some, it feels like some of the lessons are embedded now or becoming embedded in society. But I think there's probably still some things that will wane. I can't see those disappearing, but things like having good empathy for your staff, thinking about them first. It's hard to do when you're in under pressure to deliver. I'll admit myself, I've been there in situations where I need to talk to someone, I need to chat, I need to deal with them on that. Right, I'll do that later. Right, oh, this is on my desk now, I've got to get this done. Oh, I'll go and see, oh no, if this is coming. And I've got to the point where I've missed, I knew the individual was struggling, I knew they needed my support,
right,
and they went off ill. And I beat myself up on that because I wasn't there ready. I knew it. I was trying to get there. I didn't get there because other things got in the way. And I think nowadays, I'm better at spotting when I'm delaying those things just because, oh, I'll sort it later, because that it's that important and urgent thing, and the people are the important, and the work is not is the urgent sometimes. Whereas if you focus on the people, those urgent things reduce because they get sorted.
Yeah, I think the mental health issues did get elevated during this time because it was very stressful. I mean, and you couldn't miss it. And so it did get elevated. My concern, because I think one of the last questions we asked the leaders, did you conduct an after-action review when this all and you went, you know, went back to work and the like. Did you conduct an after-action? And people said, mostly what people said, oh, we did it sort of informally, which made me question whether anything was done. And I think that was a big miss, because everybody was so anxious to go back to the way they were working, bring big people back into the office, start up, get the restaurants working again and the like, that they didn't really take the time to do it. And this is something that we've been pushing. In fact, I just finally just put out an article. I just posted it on LinkedIn.
I noticed that a couple of days ago.
Yeah, on how to do an after-action review, asking people, did their organization do it? And then in the article, and it's not that, it's a very short article because it doesn't take that much, it's not that much to it. There's a lot to it in the outcomes that you get if you do it, but just teaching people what are the right questions to ask and how do you go about doing and so forth. And, you know, I hope people look at that article, and it's still not too late to do it, to set aside a couple of hours with the leadership team and maybe with a representative from the workforce to come in and talk about what did we learn, what did we do well, what didn't we do well, what did we miss, what should we do differently next time. And you can learn a heck of a lot from that. As you know, as a project manager, Nigel, you do it at the end of a project, or at least good project managers do it at the end of a project, and they say, all right, how did it go, right?
I think that lessons learned thing is something I see as a in projects is something we should be looking at all the way along some of the sort of more agile methodologies where you're more you're reflective on a regular basis rather than at the end, because the danger you have at the end of a project, if you've got a 9-month project, a 12-month project, the people at the end of the project aren't the people who were at the beginning of the project. So the fact that it's a bag of spanners at the end, maybe things that we could have done at the beginning that no one was around trying to fix. So I think there's benefit, and you need to do it all the way along. I think what I see from organisations, and I think what I'm seeing is that there are probably lessons learned that people learn and are taking forward, but aren't consciously doing that review that you're talking about and going, hang on a minute, where's our new kit bag of tools ready to have them and have that be able to go, right, we've got this issue, what's the playbook for that? Because I think there's probably some playbook that could detail out their playbooks and then go, right, okay, that didn't work, change that, we've got that ready, keep it. It's like your disaster recovery, your business continuity pack. And essentially, every organisation had a business continuity plan, which I think was probably suboptimal for what we went through, which means that business continuity plan needs to be uplifted a bit, whether that be from business practice, whether that be from communication, using daily rituals and those sort of things, and that changing those. And some of those will fit into what we've got down, because the hybrid working driven some of that good quality rituals now is kind of embedded in organisations a little bit. But I think I understand that it's kind of that lessons learned, that retrospective is something every organisation should be doing. And I don't, from my organisation, I don't know whether people are doing it all the way up here, but the bigger the organisation is, the more of them that should be done at different banks, because different parts of the organisation would have held it in different. But it's an investment, right. I suppose, and I suppose everyone was keen to get back to normality.
Yeah. Right, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'm just looking at the time, and we're just nearly coming up on the hour. It's been a fascinating conversation, as I knew it would be. And I suppose, just cover off the last few minutes. What, if you were going to talk to someone about either being better in becoming a better positive influence for their teams. What would you say to do first? What's the first thing that you say? Go tomorrow morning. This is what I would do if I was you.
Can I say go buy the book? Or?
Of course you can. That's it. Aside from go buy the book.
Let me tell you,
buy the book. There'll be a link in the show notes, everyone. So jump on a copy.
There's a serious part to saying that, because the book was built for people to use it as a guide for learning. Because at the end of every chapter, there are four questions that get you to reflect on what you just read. For example, if there's a chapter in the book on leadership in a crisis about the major challenges that leaders faced. And at the end, one of the questions, the review questions is, what challenges did you face in your organization, in your industry, and how did you cope with them? Well, that's that question can produce a heck of a lot of learning. And so that's why I say, the book is a great place to start. Both books, if you want to talk about the first book, which is How to Be a Positive Influence Leader, that's the questions are there too. And there's also the self-assessment that I mentioned at the back of that book. And the publisher has been kind enough to publish it as a separate booklet so that it makes it a lot easier than doing it in the book. In the book on leadership in a crisis, at the end of that book, there's a organizational assessment on what were the major crises that we faced and how well did we address them. And so that's a good way of doing it, in the sense of, okay, we can learn from our own experience. Because I always think experience-based learning is the most powerful
and has
the most lasting impact. And so that's why I suggest it. And that's why, going back to the start of our conversation, I always write for practitioners, because this is what practitioners do. They get through with a project and they say, what did we learn? How did we do? What do we do different next time? And so we doing the same kind of thing here, making experience the basis for learning. So that's what I've been doing my whole life, is experience-based learning.
Yeah, that's super powerful.
That's where I would go.
Cool, brilliant. Thank you for that. So if people want to find out more, what's the best way, or get in touch with you? What's the best way to connect? What's the best way to find out more about the books or about you in general?
Well, there's the website. The website is thepositiveinfluenceleader.com, and there you'll find information. We've written a bunch of articles since the publication of the book, of both books. And there's more that haven't even been posted yet. And also there are interviews and talks that we've given, podcasts that we've done that are also on this website.
All right, cool.
Plus we have a blog called Stories of Positive Influence, where people sent in, and I certainly encourage your listeners to do the same, their personal story of positive influence, meaning someone who helped them by being a positive influence on them. So they can go and see what I mean. And we're talking 200-300 words. We're not talking about, even an article length, but a very concise description of, I worked, My first manager was Nigel, and he did the following things, and it had a great impact on me for the following reason. And then we make a little comment about this little story as to how it fits into the overall idea of being a positive influence leader. I encourage you to do that. So you can contact me. You can send in your story of positive influence to me, Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, at thepositiveinfluenceleader.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, pretty active on LinkedIn, post a lot of things there, and you can certainly contact me. I encourage you to connect with me on LinkedIn, send me a message. I do read, and I do follow up, and I do respond, and I encourage you to get in touch with us that way as well.
Brilliant. Well, Glenn, thank you very much for giving me so much time and being a positive influence on me. Hopefully it's been a positive influence to all of my listeners. Have a brilliant rest of your day.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate it, Nigel.
Brilliant. Thanks, Glenn. Bye. Another great sponsor of the show comes in the form of Air Manual. Air Manual is it's a tool for documenting process, which and best practices. It's a company formed by one of my interviewees, Alexis Kingsbury. I kind of summarised why. My view of where you see documentation, a lot of my experience has been people will document something, a process, they'll put it in a Visio diagram that gets loaded onto a SharePoint site or something similar, and then once that diagram's been shared with senior management, they're happy they have a process in the business, but then the detailed procedures underneath it might be with documents in just poorly kept and not linked easily and not updated. And what Air Manual does, it allows you to put in it's a tool for doing this kind of thing. You whack it in, the service in there, get in there, put in your process, your flow, and you build it down to as low a level of detail, even to the point of checklists where people can check off they've done it. So it creates that guided checklists, easy to create, easy to maintain, and all in one place. And no one's kind of rooting around to find the SharePoint, and then when you change to new SharePoint services and all that stuff, it's all there. So if you pop along to nigelpreisser.com/airmanual, there's a bit more detail there and a link there to click on to go and get. I think they offer a trial and things like that. So it's something that I think can easily reduce the amount of errors, rework, etc. within our organization. So take a look. Well, I am sure you enjoyed that second part of that interview. Come back next week for the final guest interview of the year. Speak soon. Bye. So this is my final wrap-up. Every week you're going to hear this. You're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you listened to this podcast to the end of this show and you think, that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nigel out, there are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast, send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links or send them to www.nigelcreisser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreisser.com/podcasts. And that'll push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreisser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics, I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well, and I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/sundaylunchpm. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye. The latest affiliate that I've got on the show now is Riverside. I use Riverside to do my interviews, Riverside FM. it kind of offers you a whole, if you like, micro studio management producer tooling and goes beyond that. Has a really good free layer. And I've been using it for a while now. I find it really good. When I've had issues, even though I'm not on one of the higher paid levels, the support has been quick, responsive and high quality, and people keen to help me. The organization seems really good. The product seems really intuitive, and quality is really good as well. And it's a clever way of doing it is when you're recording through your browsers, so you've not got loads of desktop resources being used compared to some other products that I've used. And what they also do is they do they stream a lower quality version of it up onto as you're doing the interview, so you're not burning bandwidth while you're doing the interview and potentially impacting on the quality of the conversation. And then at the end, it uploads it, the higher quality from your browser. It's just a really good way of doing it. So if you are thinking of doing a podcast, know someone who's doing a podcast, I would recommend using this tool. I found it really good. Best of the tools that I've tried using to date. And you can get that at nigelcreaser.com/riverside, and that will redirect you to my kickback page on their site, and there I will get a little kickback from them. So take a look. Thanks. Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.